Before we get into today's episode, I want to share a quick note. This episode is part of a series I'm calling The Episodes That Built My Practice. What started as simple conversations, really coffee chats, with professionals across the industry turned into something much more impactful than I ever expected. These are the people taking time out of their day to share their stories, their experiences, and how they navigated their careers. And over time, those conversations started to shape how I think. They helped me build confidence, work through imposter syndrome, and better understand what it really takes to grow in this profession, and eventually to start my own practice. So I'm bringing back the episodes that had the biggest impact on me, 25 episodes, because sometimes one conversation can change how you see your entire career path. And I hope these do the same for you. I hope you enjoy listening to the 25 episodes that really shaped and built my career. And in the show notes below, I'm going to start off the show notes with the impactful lesson I learned from this individual. So don't forget to check out the show notes to see what the lesson was before you listen to this story. Hello, and welcome to the Mentor Dino YouTube channel. I'm your host, Caitlin Rosier. I am an architect and founder of Mentor Dino. Each week, I interview amazing professionals in and around the architecture, engineering, and construction industry to help foster learning, growth, and inspiration in others. Thank you all to our current subscribers, and if you're new, we'd love to have you join our community. So hit subscribe. It really does help others be able to discover this resource. So let's dive in. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Welcome, everybody, to the Mentor Dino podcast. I'd like to welcome Alice Anderson, CEO and founder of Wonderstruck. And thank you, Alice, for taking the time to speak with me today.
Absolutely.
Now, before we get started, I want to just talk about Wonderstruck in general to set some context for anybody who has no idea what your company does. And you do so much, so I did not want to even take an attempt. Can you give the high level on what you do at Wonderstruck?
Sure. So I kind of want to blend the introduction from what we do and my past, kind of what I've studied and how it came into fruition.
Let's go for it.
My major was building construction. I went to the University of Florida. They have a program there called the Rinker School of Building Construction. I think it's the best. There are a lot of great construction schools all over the country. So my degree was actually on the more technical side. And then after school, I actually was a superintendent building homes for a few years, decided to transition into commercial construction. And when I did, I ended up working on the pre-con and marketing side. So I was helping put proposals together. But I had this rare knack for writing. And there was sort of this moment of, oh, aha, we can have a field, technically minded field person helping us with these proposals to be a little bit more oriented towards the project. So, you know, I can't, just for the sake of NDA, I can't name all the projects that I was on, but a few of them were really big airports across the country. And we ended up going and touring the airports. And I would tour them with other engineers and project managers and understand the technicalities of how, if my company were to win the project, how they would build it, how they would phase it. And I was able to translate that into a proposal, into graphics, into phasing plans, and really enjoyed doing that. I ended up leaving that company and going to an integrated design build firm so I could learn a little more about the architecture side. Ended up touching a bit of development as well as construction. Learned a lot more and then decided to open my own company. I say that casually, like I just woke up one day and was like, I'm going to start a company. But it was more of a like, oh, you know what? I'm going to try a freelance thing. And I had a good book of business based on my previous experiences with my previous employers, their partners that we would bring into pursuits. And so the company really started out as just helping with proposals. And in the AEC industry, I think there is this disconnect that a lot of people don't quite understand how you win the work. So an architect or a contractor, if you're in construction, you're in the field, or you're an architect and you're designing, there was a whole team at the very forefront of this project getting placed on your desk that had to go out and convince someone to let you do that work. And that's what the marketing team does. And I think what I've loved about AEC marketing is it's not the traditional marketing. It's not, you put your brand on a billboard, you put your brand in an ad. Sure, we do that stuff, but it's very technical and you have to be able to wow people using pretty involved proposals about your business, about how you're going to build their product, how you're going to design it. And so when I started freelancing, and to be honest, I started a blog and I, a long time ago before I even started Wonderstruct as a company. And I was like, I like the name Wonderstruct. We'll just call that my freelancing entity. And then about 4 or 5 months into just freelancing, I had a pretty good book of business. And one of my best friends from college was, she was at a marketing agency and wanted to leave. And I took that opportunity to bring her into my world. And with her came all sorts of marketing. So what we've been able to do with the two of us is open a marketing firm that first started out as strictly proposals and expand it into true digital marketing. We do a ton of websites. We do social media campaigns. We do asset libraries where we kind of come in and build out all your company resumes, all your project sheets. And we ask the questions, what makes these people stand out if we put them in proposals or feature them on your website? Same with projects. So our marketing approach isn't just proposals because it's very all-encompassing. Since then, we grew, we added more people and got into a little bit of PR as it felt relevant to the industry. To be honest, it started out with just helping contractors get out in the community and find subcontractors. So that was the PR we found the most beneficial to AEC at the time. And now we do a little more true PR. So that in a nutshell is a little bit the blend of my background, my business partner, Donna, her background, and then how we both kind of came together to create what Wonderstruct is today. I should mention one other service, and I did this when I was in the field with the two commercial construction companies I worked with, but we write safety plans, site logistics plans, design plans. Donna is working right now on, can't go into detail, but one of the biggest airports in the country / the world. She has partnered with one of the biggest design firms and is working on cut sheets and design sheets and really redlining them and making sure that the final design book and design requirements for this airport are clean, are straightforward, are easy to understand. So design standards, when any concessionaires come in, are straightforward, which that's been a really fun thing for us to do with the architecture side. But unique, different. You don't think of marketing, you think of that.
So that one's for any of the small retail entities that end up filling the airport. So then they have their own design guidelines that they have to meet and check off. And then they have their own spots to do their own branding.
Exactly. And we run QC with them. So they go in and they say, this is what you can do with signage. This is what you can't do. Here are the 4 or 5 storefront options you can pick from. And Donna and our team, they'll go through the design. Just they'll go through and make sure the story is consistent. If we're saying you can't have railings in this part of the restaurant and you say that throughout the proposal and then we show a railing at that part of the restaurant and one of the cut sheets. Okay, let's talk about it. Let's clean it up. And I have to say, I've been very impressed. Our whole marketing team, when you hire people in marketing, they don't think that that's what they're going to end up doing, but it's really fun. And it makes a big difference to be able to have an outside eye QC alongside design firms.
Yeah. And then so is your education's more on the construction side. Is Donna's straight marketing?
Straight marketing. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I've always wondered how marketing students figure out marketing within AEC firms, because I feel it's pretty detached and you almost need to have that technical eye. Or one of my friends is a marketer now, but her education for her bachelor's degree is actually interior design. So she has at least an interior design background and then went into marketing, which tends to give her a little bit more of a ease in understanding the designs and being able to communicate it. So just curious how marketing professionals discover this part of the industry.
You know, I find that the individuals who do really well in marketing in AEC, if they had a marketing background, they are actually very project management oriented. So, you know, you have your marketers that are full on creatives. They want to sit down, they want to design stuff, they want to like create campaigns that have quirky, fun messages and all of that, which you can do in AEC to a certain extent. But I think that the marketers that really succeed in the AEC side come in with a project management mindset, because it is very, one, proposals are so involved. You have to understand getting a draft redlining. You have to understand budgets and schedules. You have to understand timelines and deadlines. You have to kind of strip yourself of any pride in your like design work, you know, because
you have a bunch of designers staring at it.
Yes, exactly. It's just like in architecture, they teach you to redline the heck out of everything. Like no design is perfect, nothing is perfect. And I do think in marketing, a lot of times marketing has this like, just come up with creative ideas. And well, yes, you do that in AEC. You also have to be very project management oriented and very timely and very detailed. You have to have a good idea of grammar. You have to also be able to, when you're reading your work, I think it's also very helpful when someone who is a marketing background comes into AEC and they'll read a proposal or they'll even read a white paper or anything and they put it down. They're like, I have no idea what this says. Well, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. That's an issue, because a lot of owners don't have, a lot of people that you're trying to sell to don't have the technical background. A lot of them do, but a lot don't. And so I think that first I've just noticed, and I think Donna and Carrie on my team are two prime examples of project management oriented people. They are organized, detailed, quick, and very meticulous with their steps and their processes and getting stuff done. And the beauty in what we've been doing in having those individuals run as our project managers and getting things done, we've been able to appreciate the creative side a little bit more. And, you know, I want to put this delicately. You can appreciate the creative side a little bit more when you don't have as many technical people in the company. Mm-hmm. And that's something sometimes we struggle with in-house, primarily on the contractor side, not so much with architectural, but I say the contractor side, but also we work in renewable energy. We work in transportation. Sometimes, you know, when you try to get a little creative with a pretty straightforward technical field, it can get stifled. The nice thing with us is people do come to us as a third party to just explore that creativity a bit more. So we have a couple graphic designers on staff that have more, they can push it a little bit. And they work with the project management oriented minds to add, you know, a really cool graph that tells a story instead of eight paragraphs explaining it. So we really try to push the visual education and the visual marketing as much as possible in this very technical world, because that's the best way the layman or outside folks understand it.
Yeah, and the proposals can get pretty big, especially if you're going after airports. Like, they are massive. And when an owner is trying to read through everything,
yeah,
it's very unlikely that they're actually reading word for word. So if something can be illustrated as a graphic and then them go to some words to understand it more, that's a quicker way to get your point across and just that you can communicate in different ways.
100%. So. And I would even say one thing that, you know, where AI is playing a big role in what we do these days, embrace it or get out of the business, because it's here, here to stay, especially with marketing. And our team's been training a ton on AI. And, you know, we could easily, I'll be the first to tell you, we could easily go into every proposal question and generate an AI answer. Still, the same rules apply. No one's going to go read novel after novel. So we have to have really creative people who, if we show them a paragraph and we read it to them and we go, how can we show this instead of say it? They come up with those sort of ideas. So, you know, it's funny you say that with the industry background. It definitely helps that I have an industry background. 100%. That project management mindset paired with the true creative, and they're very different, different ways of thinking. They have to come together, and they're most often two different people. That's kind of the secret sauce for a successful collaboration, because a proposal takes up way more than one type of marketing mind. And real quick, kind of what you said, it can get really big. Mm-hmm. The toughest proposals, the toughest marketing and campaigns in general, are the collaborative ones where you have like five team members. So let's say you have an architecture firm, two engineering firms, a contractor, a smaller local contractor, and a consultant. All of them are coming in for one proposal. That's seven opinions on a 100-page document, or seven opinions on a joint venture brand or letterhead. So I think
different styles of how they lay it out. I've seen just, you know, we get engineers in that we're consulting with, and their style of how they lay out a proposal is drastically different. And you want to look like one team, even though you're bringing together multiple businesses. So it's like, okay, what works for the design? So you don't look like, hey, we just got this and slapped it in, and you can tell it's somebody else's stuff. Yeah. We want to come together as one.
Yeah. And when done well, a proposal that, and I keep saying a proposal, it's reflected, like joint ventures require more than just a proposal to be branded to show a collaborative idea. But if your design package is disjointed down to your engineers and your architects all have different, you know, formats to put their drawings in, it looks like, okay, did you guys even get in the same room and talk?
Yeah.
And, you know, it looks messy. It's not cohesive. So what does that say about the relationship too? So marketing for AEC is really, it's how can we make them all collectively look like they have this one cohesive idea in this proposal, in these documents, in this letterhead. And that gets really tricky. And there's always going to be one more difficult team member that their opinion or no way. And that's where that project management person comes in again, because a good project manager isn't just organized. They know how to negotiate. They know how to speak to difficult people. They know how to compromise. They know how to come up with solutions that will make maybe not everyone happy, but that will work across the board. And that's probably, in my book, the biggest success indicator of someone who can market in AEC.
Yeah, definitely with seeing marketing and seeing proposals come together, and oftentimes you don't have a lot of time to put them together. Do you have any advice for anybody, either internally or externally, working with all these entities to gather the information? I know as a consultant, you don't have the luxury of knowing all the firm's past projects. So there is a lot more digging you have to do to figure out those stories and entities. Do you have any advice for getting everybody on one page and moving forward?
Sure. Gosh, I have a lot of advice. I would say, you know, I think first of all, when you pick representatives in any company to go work with a marketing team, whether they're in-house or a third party out of house, And I struggle sometimes because I will be the first to admit to you, my life as a third party is a lot easier than it was when I was in-house. And that is the blunt truth, because executives and people paying me as a third party care more about what I have to say in my direction than they did when I was in-house. And I'm not saying, I have some wonderful mentors. I worked with some great people in-house. But prioritize your marketing team's needs, because it can get very frustrating. First of all, there's a good chance your marketing team isn't compensated the same as your technical people. They probably don't get the same notoriety, the same, you know, I don't want to say respect, because I always felt respected, but they're looked at a little bit differently. They're not, they're overhead. They're looked at as,
that's what I was going to say. They're not billable. Yeah, so then oftentimes, like, yep. I'm more on the architecture side. If they're
in the construction. Yeah.
But on the architect side, since I'm an architect and mainly worked in architecture firms, if they knew what to do with you, if you were an architect, it gets blurry sometimes with the interior designers. And then the second you're in more of a non-billable role, whether it be administration, accounting, marketing, architects aren't taught all of that business side and how important those are for the whole business to come together. You need those billable professionals, but because we aren't trained necessarily always on the business side, I think architects struggle with that entity and that value because they don't see it as bill. I haven't worked, but
it's, I don't know. You nailed it. Same thing. It really is. And it's to no one's fault. It's just the way it's like, you know, I think that when you go to college, you get a degree in marketing, you come out and you do marketing in AEC, there is this one point in a lot of our marketing folks' life that they feel, I feel like I'm a little bit administrative more than a marketer. And Lord knows we couldn't do anything without administration support. It's still kind of aligned with that skill set. And marketers are trained to be strategic thinkers. They're trained to be creative. So when you are working with a marketing team, understand that even if they're in-house, they're not there to just like collect your stuff and make it look pretty. Bring them into the hard conversations. Bring them into the go, no go. I can't tell you how frustrating. I have a couple. Oh my gosh, if my old boss hears this, he's going to be like, oh my God, I can't believe she admitted that. But I remember just getting so pissed off one day that there was this potential project that the company was going to chase. And nobody said, yeah, let's go for it or let's not go for it. I was never brought in the discussion. So immediately we all assumed we're not going for it. They would have told us by now. And then 5 days before it was due, it was like, oh, okay, actually, we're going to go for it. And it just felt very disrespectful. And it felt very like, oh, well, we don't need to bring you guys in the conversation. We as leadership need to figure out if we're going to go for it or not. And it was like, you know, you bring your project managers and your superintendents, you even bring your junior engineers into conversations about how you're going to build a building. Bring your marketing team into whether or not you should go for this project. They have ideas. They've been trained to do this. So I think there is the request of respect your marketing team as the professionals they are. Get them in early. Get them to be part of the conversations, especially when it comes to should we go for this or should we not? Because they're going to make it a priority. Where you guys might not make it a priority because it's not your billable every day. Your marketing team is, and they'll stay on it and they'll make sure that, you know, there's an adequate amount of time to get the materials together. Then if you decide to go for a pursuit and you're working with a marketing team, again, in-house or not, sit down. Usually the marketing team has a preferred method of collecting materials. Most companies have an asset library, where they keep all of their assets. And, you know, it's more just sit down with your marketing team and go, here are our top three reasons we're going for this. here's what we've done. Here's what the three ways we'll stand apart to win this project. And here are the people we want to showcase and the project. Like, here's the information you need. That conversation can happen so quickly, and a marketer can take that and run. Mm-hmm. I remember, not getting the name of resumes or project examples until 3 or 4 days before it was due. And it was like, we could have been doing resumes. We could have been building this out. We could have, there's just so much you can do when you bring the marketing team in early. And it's funny because architects, engineers, contractors, developers, everyone always tries to get a client to bring them on early. Mm-hmm. No matter where you are, that's like, bring us on early. You'll get the most value. Same with your marketing team, 100%. Yep.
And if you're in the meetings, you can just hit the ground running. It's not, they had the meeting. Now you have to have a whole nother meeting to explain to you. And then it's like telephone. Yep. But even though you're not billable, there's still time to allocate. If you're going after 5 proposals right now, that's part of the discussion too. It's, hey, we're going after these 5 other projects right now that were definitely a go and really align with everything. Does this 6th project really align to our vision and goals? Do we want to go for it and stretch? Do we have the capacity to stretch? Yeah. So I've seen a lot of marketers just get burned out when there's not that discussion. And then all of a sudden, like, it's like a waterfall. When projects start coming in the door to go for proposals, I feel like they just come in waves and you get hit.
Oh, big time. Our phones, like, I feel like Wonderstruck, there are 3 or 4 times a year that off the hook, we're just answering calls, helping fill a lot of orders. And I do think one thing we try to do is when we go in and we talk to a client and they're like, well, we have 20 proposals we want to get done this month. We have to meet this benchmark. It's like, actually, take a step back. Mm-hmm. Let's look at the top 10 of those. Do you have a network? Are you like, I do think a lot of companies try to just fling proposals out there to see what sticks. And that never works in comparison to a good strategic proposal where you have an existing relationship where you could win the work because you have the experience or you have team members the client likes. And it's hard though, when there are so many unknowns in the economy, right? And I always mm-hmm. know when people are a little nervous with the economy because we blow up the minute, which is great. Marketing blows up when people are unsure, but you can tell right now people are just trying to get as much bandwidth and as much coverage as possible to win work. And that's not always the right strategy, even in, unknown times. I also thought about a story earlier with, we were saying bringing the marketing team in, and even though they're overhead, bring them in because they're overhead. They got the time, they mm-hmm. have the hours, like they're not charging you to go into that meeting. And I remember going into a meeting in particular back in the day, I did a ton of data center proposals, and there was a new cooling system that the contractor I worked with had done successfully for the first time ever on another project. And this particular project was exploring that idea. Wasn't in the RFP, wasn't something I would know about unless I had been in that meeting. Well, unfortunately, I have construction background, but I could dig a little bit more. And we did this whole cool visual on the cooling system, how it was installed, and more importantly, like the post-construction value it brought. And had I not sat in there, and I remember one of the, PMs going like, oh, if you hadn't sat in here, we probably wouldn't have done that big of a visual or made a big deal. And they won mm-hmm. the project. So don't be afraid of your marketing team's creativity. Pull them in.
Yeah. You never know their background either.
Yeah. So. That's so true. So true.
Yeah. Can we step back to your superintendent days? Because sure. I would have to say I have never met a female superintendent. I think all of my supers have been males. What was your experience on the superintendent side? I've generally only interacted with supers from the architect's perspective.
Sure.
So what are you doing beyond me bugging you, or are you bugging me with questions? Like, what all were you putting together for anybody that's interested in being a super?
Oh, that's a great question. So I was a superintendent called a field manager for a home builder, Track Home Builder. So I built about 50 something houses in an active adult community in the Carolinas. And, you know, I was very green, fresh out. I mean, fresh out of college, bright eyed and bushy tailed, poor me. It was an awesome experience. I had to learn. I did a lot of shadowing for my first probably 6 months to learn, okay, step by step, here's how you build a house. And luckily the company I worked for had a really great program in terms of training and in terms of our daily checklist. So it took, I believe it was like 55 days to build a house on average. Depending on floor plan and stuff, it was like 45 to 65 or something like that. But
yeah.
For each house that I built, I'd be given a schedule and a checklist. And I had a day by day what I would go into the field, check and make sure, okay, is the lumber here? The lumber's here. Check it. Is it quality lumber? Did they give us garbage? Are we going to be able to build with it? Is it warped? No, all looks good. If it is, I have to go and reorder it. And then, you know, it was a lot of very hands-on double checking everybody's work. So I, you know, it was a blast. If I could get back out in the field a little bit more, I would. When I worked in construction, I would go to all the concrete pours and write about, just because I had sort of been in the field. And I say sort of because it was on the residential side. It was a lot smaller than the big commercial buildings. But I loved it. It was really fun. It was a lot of work. It was very hard. And not because I was a woman, actually, that I had a lot of respect when I got out into the field. There was another female superintendent at the company, but I was young. And I was 24 building homes for 55 plus seniors. So the biggest challenge for me wasn't necessarily building the house. It was communicating with the homeowners that I've got you. I've got this covered. And, you know, I was fresh into the industry. So sometimes and of course I made mistakes. It was my first job out of college. And there's not as much grace when you're young and, you know, these older folks who are experienced and knowledgeable, in their minds probably think like, I could manage this.
Yeah. This kid's building my house. Is it even going to stay up?
Yeah. Like, how old are you? And of course I had this baby face. And, but I remember we had to get ranked. They had like surveys at the end of the year. So it was like rate your builder 1 through 10. And, I ended up after my first year going into my second year, I got the highest ranking for home builder, like as a home builder superintendent for, my neighborhood. And it was like this moment of, okay, I have figured this out. And there's nothing more satisfying than being a superintendent in construction. Project management's fun. I do enjoy it. It's more, you know, you're in the office, you're dealing with the numbers and strategy. Marketing's a blast. It's very creative. Obviously, I love doing it. But man, there is something. And you have to have your heart and soul in construction, because it is devilish hours. And
it's not for the faint of heart either.
It is not. No, no. I mean, and it's a competition. If you talk to superintendents, you know, they're like, yeah, I did 80 hours last week. And, you know, I didn't even sleep a day. And there's a lot of pride. And the best superintendents I've ever worked with, man, their life was their job. So I would say it's awesome. It's really fun. It's like giant arts and crafts. It's gritty, which I also really liked the gritty side. It's definitely not as polished as the office side, but it's a camaraderie that you'll never find anywhere else, especially with work crews. But it's really hard work. It's really hard work. I recommend everyone, if you're in college and you're in architecture or engineering or construction, do one summer internship in the field. Just do it. Just go, like, find a construction company, find a developer, and get one summer of that street cred, because there is nothing that will help you more than understanding the guts and the bones of everything you're building and being a part of it. So yeah. I would highly recommend that.
Yeah, I definitely wish I did that because when I was in school, it was still, the economy was crap. And I didn't have an internship at an architecture firm until I had a bachelor's degree. And so it was like, oh, if I had the balls to be a female and go ask a contractor, like, hey, I'm an architect, let me go. Like, I wish somebody gave me that advice to be like, no, you got this. Who cares about your age, your gender? Go. And I've actually talked to a number of less supers that I've worked with. And they're like, oh, yeah, like we would take an architect to come in as an intern and you can just see this side of construction and see how things physically get built.
Well, and like the superintendents, we look at the drawings every single day. Like when I was out in the field, even with the houses, which again, much smaller scale, but I had my drawings in my hands because if something looked off, I'd have to reference the drawings. If there was an issue with the drawings and it was reflected in the project, we had to figure that out. And just as an architect to understand that creation, the process of creating your design, there's just a credibility that's really, really great. It's not necessary, but man, it's helpful.
And being able to talk to the construction team, I feel like there's a lot of times there's all this angst between the design team and the contractors, and it doesn't need to be that way. The best projects I've been on is when I can work hand in hand with the contractors. If something doesn't work, hey, let's look at it. I want to see it in the field. Let's take a look. Let's problem solve together. How would you build it? Let's see if it aligns with these goals and check in. I like my projects just because I can map out the whole floor plan. Like I'll do giant square footage buildings and I can pretty much hand sketch out every room. I may not know the room number, but I know the room, where it's located, and what is happening in that space. And it's just, no, let me tell you what the client would worry about in this instance. And, okay, I like that idea. I didn't think of that because I'm not building it every day. But I've learned so much from the superintendents I've worked with. Probably light years more than my architects. No offense to everybody I've worked with on the architecture side. But, like, the knowledge you gain on site's just crazy and helpful.
Well, and the funny thing is, I think sometimes superintendents get a bad rap in that they're grittier, or they might be edgier, and they are so passionate about what they do. And they're so in the weeds with what they do that I found when I was this marketing girl, they had no idea I had been a superintendent, had been in the field. Maybe they knew I had a degree in construction. Maybe they didn't. Mm-hmm. But I remember every time I was like, hey, could I go to a pour? Could I come see these prefabricated panels when you guys, erect them? Can I come watch that or be a part of it, get pictures? Oh my God, they love it. They're so excited. If you just ask, they're all about it. They're all about sharing their knowledge. So I find that the superintendent side is, it's a great, great side of construction to respect and get experience with.
Yeah, definitely. So let's jump back over to the business side and starting your own company. You talked a little bit on kind of freelancing to start and then building it up. When did you have that decision to make it full time and not just a freelance gig?
Oh, man. You know, I've always been miss sign up for everything. I want to do it all for sure. It would be silly of me to tell you, well, it's not in my personality to just start a business.
I took a quiz and it said to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah, it's like, ooh, you seem like you could do this. I've always been, entrepreneur curious, if you will, but never really had the push to just do it. And if I'm going to be completely vulnerable, my last company I worked with had layoffs and I was a part of those. And it was devastating. It was one of those where I was like, wait a minute, I did everything right. And I had just gotten a raise and a bonus and we won work. Like, I don't understand. And I had remembered, and this is kind of a side note that I love telling this because anyone who's been let go kind of knows that feeling, or anyone who's left a job that it was hard. There's a center called the Women's Business Development Center in Chicago. And I was living in Chicago at the time. And I had a friend who was starting a jewelry business. And she was a jeweler in the Chicago Jeweler District. And she was like, well, if you ever want to, you know, join me on this journey, I really thought about it. And I was like, okay, well, entrepreneur-wise, this would be new for me, but I'm curious. I have a great job. Probably not going to leave that, but I'm curious. Let's look into this. So the Women's Business Development Center, which there are, WeBank is it's kind of the federal term for it. They're all over the country and in all major cities. If you are a woman and you want to start a business, go to your woman's, go to that center, find your local one, because they'll help you. So they had a starting a business 101 workshop one night. Again, I was employed, looking to help a friend, and I went to that workshop. And the worksheet itself said, do you have family in this line of work? This was for jewelry. No, I don't. My friend did. I did not. Do you have an education in this? Do you have experience with partnerships in this? And the final one was, have you ever been fired? And it was very interesting to see on a questionnaire to say if you were ready to be an entrepreneur. And you got a point towards being an entrepreneur if you had been fired. So basically, they were saying they noticed that there is an affiliation with entrepreneurs and the ability to experience risk or to experience loss. And I will say the day that I was let go, that was the first thing that came to my mind is like, oh man, I've got nothing to lose. I could go try this now.
Mm-hmm.
Like I could see where this goes. I had written, and 2 months before that, serendipitously, I had written down my whole book of business based on my experiences with my previous firms, and who I could call to potentially get work to do freelance proposals. And I was like, okay, I've literally done all the prep work for this. I have the education in it. I have the background in it. I have family in this too. Not that that was necessarily what I needed, but now I finally have this one piece where I was let go and I am much more available to take a risk. And so I did. And I called all of those contacts from that list. I landed 3 clients within that first month. And it was really hard. It was just me. But I called a friend, my friend Jenna, who actually works with us now. She was an editor. And I was like, do you want to do this with me? Help me edit my proposals. She said, sure. And then about 4 months later, we were getting more work. And Donna called me and was like, you know what? I've done print. I've done QC. I've done all sorts of marketing. I'm leaving my agency. What do you need help with? And then we really kicked it off from there. COVID hit within 7 months of us starting it. So you want to talk about like quick risk
timing,
but oh my gosh, I just like, I remember when it hit and we were just like, oh, cool, cool. Now that we have a good book of business. So it hit and there was this pause. And then when COVID kind of, we passed a little bit of COVID and got into the end of 2020, phones were ringing off the hook. People needed to win work and get back to work. They had laid off their marketing teams. They needed us to help. So we really built a team off of that. We brought in team members that were great when we were a small company and we were young and we had smaller clients. We grew out of that. We got bigger clients. I would say the hardest part of business ownership is realizing you may have to let people go. Realizing that you may have to hire a different type of talent to get to the next level. And I would say that lesson, I wouldn't wish it on anyone, if I'm going to be honest. If you were to ask me to go back and start the business over and go through everything I've gone through in the past 4 years, I would say absolutely not. But I'm here today and I love it. I stuck with it. I think Donna and I are hard-headed. We were willing to work for half of our worth to get us to where we are. So you just have to love, I feel like if you're owning a business, you have to love the idea of owning a business more than the idea of being rich and successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's not about getting everything perfect either.
No.
So even, even though you say you wouldn't redo everything as you did over the last 4 years, it still created who you are today. And decisions, oftentimes you have to take a risk to open up your own business, but you also have to take risks along the way to learn how to grow, but understand when you need to pivot. And if something's not working, and accept, hey, that didn't work. What did I learn from it? Where do I need to go and move from here?
Yeah. Well, and there's a great way to look at it. It's either pivot. Don't say, like, you either pivot, you don't say no, or you don't change. And so you can't, or pivot, quit, or don't change. And you can't quit. If you want to be successful, you just have to, there has to be this endurance that's psychotic, if I'm going to be honest. We often say, like, business owners are psychotic. And the older, the more I get into this, the more I'm like, oh my God, of course they are. You can't be fazed by putting people's livelihoods on the line because you have to build the business up for the other employees. Which I am fazed. I'm an emotional person. I have feelings. Mm-hmm. I've been fired. I know how that feels. I hate that part. You have to let clients go that are tough on your people, but then fill that pipeline. And your staff doesn't see they're just kind of like, this is a tough client. Why aren't we getting rid of them? Well, do you want your paycheck? So there has to be this crazy sense of endurance that's borderline psychotic. And you have to be okay making really hard decisions that impact your life and other people's lives and their business. And you have to just have this like grit. You can't say no. You just don't stop. Because you don't want to. And I don't want to. I would say Donna and I are both very like, yep, this month sucks. We didn't get to pay ourselves. Anyways, next month will be better. Whereas a lot of people, rightfully so, would be like, I'm done. Go get me a constant paycheck. I want my life. I want consistency. So there is this, you just have to kind of accept endurance because it takes, what did Donna say the other day? She's like, you can become an overnight success in about 10 years. So there is, you know, you have to have that endurance. We both have really good partners that have supported us through it. Never, you know, most really good entrepreneurs have a network that they're using, whether it's family or friends. And yeah, but man, it's the most rewarding thing I've ever done. I'm pregnant right now. I'm expecting my first.
Congratulations.
Yeah, we're very excited. But one of my friends was like, are you ready? And I was like, you know what? I think I am. Not because I think I know everything I'm going to need to know about parenthood based on starting a business, but I know I've got endurance. I know I've got the, like, I can put up with anything for a long time and like still look back at it as a success. And even Donna, my business partner, who is a parent, has said many times, like, running and owning a business is harder than parenting at times. So that's kind of my soapbox rant on business. But
no, you do great. I interviewed Ashton Brooks out in Austin that owns a design build firm with her brother. And she was pregnant at the time. And I think it was, she had her son, I think, it's like fine. 4 days prior to when the actual interview released. So oh then my it was God. Like also a celebratory, here's your interview, but now you have a son. And it was like, we talked about planning and structuring, like being a business owner and transitioning to new parent and how to try to like prep to like build up your pipeline. Because if you're off, you're off whenever it's your own business. Whereas if you're in a company, you generally get maternity or paternity leave and it's okay. Sorry guys. Bye. You figure it out. And generally the company's there when you get back.
Yeah. They have the bottom line to support it. It's
exactly.
I mean, I think it'll be fine. We have a really good team and we've built up to this, but I'll have to go listen to that podcast. Cause I will say that is something that this year, Donna and I going into this year, are like, okay, well, this will be a journey.
Yeah.
You know,
we're feel free to reach out to her and ask questions because I think her son was born in October, November. I'd have to look at what my podcast date release for. But so she's like 4 months in on new mom and adjusting. So
I love it.
If you need any advice.
I mean, no.
I can't help you there. I got dogs.
Yeah, no. Again, this is my first. I'm in my late 30s. So I've watched so many other women do this. And you know what's cool is I will say, man, women in the AEC industry make some badass moms. They like, it, before I even thought, if I, you know, I was like, do I want kids? Do I not want kids and whatnot? But I do specifically remembering like they're on it. And this is not an easy industry to just work every day. It's a grind. So I love the network that I'm joining. I've always loved supporting other women in AEC anyways. And yeah, this is just another layer on it. And
yeah,
we'll see. On to the next adventure.
Before we slide off the business topic, do you have any advice for firm owners or engineers, contractors that have a bad client and Ooh. How to handle a bad client?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I would say it, my team would laugh at this, but I try my best, when it's a quote, bad client to go, what is everything that, tell me everything that we did wrong. Safe space. All right, team. I know they're a tough client. I know they've been a headache. I know all the things they've done wrong. Where are some areas we could have improved? Let's list them out. Let's talk through them. Because when I go and I talk to a client, I always want to say, one, I go, is this a client we want to keep? Am I losing mm-hmm. money on this client? Am I going to lose a really valuable team member keeping this client? And that's such a nuanced and layered decision to make. If in my mind I'm going, you know what? Yes, I lost money on this client, but we made some mistakes. We could right this ship. We could really fix this. And, you know, let's go through that. I'll sit down with my team members. My team is really good at owning up to mistakes because I own up to my mistakes and we all talk through it and we go, okay, that mistake happened. What's our solution for this next year? What are we going to put in mm-hmm. writing to show our client we're not going to do that again? So first we'll write out everything that we probably did or didn't do that could have supported the bad experience. And what solutions we should execute in the future to mitigate that ever happening again. Will it happen again? Sure. But what can we do to tee us up for success next round? Then we go over the difficulties that we've experienced from the client. And we go, okay, with each of these difficulties, is there something we can do in their contract? Is there something that we can say, hey guys, listen, we're really running into communication issues with you. In order for us to continue, to give you the level of success you need, because we acknowledge these items we could do better. Why don't we have a mandatory every other week meeting? You guys have to come. If the meeting is missed, it needs to be scheduled again that week, or else we're not going to meet the deadlines. And then everyone's sitting around and wondering if anything's getting done, which happens, right? Like mm-hmm. marketing isn't top of mind for AEC firms sometimes. So, 9 times out of 10, that approach gets us in the same room with the client and we negotiate our terms of our agreement. We just go over mm-hmm. like, hey, here's where we messed up. You know what we're going to do? We're going to put some terminology in our agreement and an addendum that protects you. So, you know, we're going to take ownership for that. We need you guys to take ownership for this part of it. Let's update and make sure that you contractually agree to the new terms that we need you to abide by. And everyone goes home happy. Because mm-hmm. Usually when there's a really big issue and a tough client, there are ways that we could approach it and improve too. There have been some situations where it's just a client that, we had a situation where an in-house marketer just didn't jive with our team mm-hmm. and went through 4 different Wonderstruck team members. And finally, it was like, guys, listen, there's only like, we've told you what we need. We've admitted to where we can maybe step it up and add value. And we're just not getting there. Is this the right fit? And going into that conversation, at the end, it wasn't the right fit. We were like, I don't think we're what you need. We're not what you're looking for. And any client loss is a bummer, but we always leave it on a note of hope to see you guys in the market. We've never had a bad, knock on wood, a bad client breakup. We have had client breakups, but it's never been malicious or difficult, because we are not afraid to go in and go, here's where we can add value. Here's where we could step it up. And I think that most issues I've run into this industry, it's just two parties wanting to point fingers and take no responsibility for improving the situation. You don't have to admit you're wrong. You can just go in and go, you know what I could do to make this better? I could do this. Does that work? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a long answer to it.
No, that's again, fantastic. Cause it's a lot of the time, not the right fit. It could be not the right fit for your project team. It could be not the right fit for you and your client. So that advice goes beyond just a bad client. That sometimes if you're a small firm owner, you are maybe dealing with more one-off clients and more learning from a bad client and moving on. But if it is a longer-term client, trying to amend it and fix it to get on the same page, it's exactly what I would do with a team member that I'm not jiving with. It's, hey, let's try to do this a different direction. Here's where I'm struggling. Where are you struggling? So it's like, how can I help you? Here's where I'm struggling, and move on. And sometimes that team member just isn't going to jive. And sometimes you learn from each other, and then you work great together after you've figured out those like learning pains.
There's also a big difference between, you don't have to like the people you work with. You don't have to like your clients. You have to respect what they do, and you have to be true to your word. And I think sometimes I struggle, I don't struggle, but sometimes I have to remind team members that it's okay if they don't like the client. That doesn't mean that they're a bad client, you know? And I it happens a lot with, I think, younger folks when they get into the workforce. There's an immediate like, well, I don't like him. He's not nice. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, you're going to find a lot of people like that.
Yep.
Like, not everyone's roses. But if you respect them and, you know, you try to make their work life easier, you'll find they'll do the same. And eventually you might end up liking one another.
Yeah.
But if you just go into it like, well, I don't like him. I don't like her. She's nice.
They don't have to be your best friend.
Yeah. This isn't you're not in a sorority. Okay. This is work. So I think it's also just making sure I have that appropriate conversation with my internal team. And let me, for the record, again, because if any of my old bosses listen to this, they're going to laugh their asses off, pardon my French, because Lord knows I could fight for what I would want or what is right. And, you know, I've had to really, really learn that being a business owner is also about being an agreeable, kind, and easy to work with person. Like, no, I'm not saying every business owner out there is kind and you know, willing to compromise, but the good ones really are. The good ones really do sit down and empathize with their clients. They don't just sit there and go, oh good, you're complaining. They sit there and go, ooh, those are some real issues. Like, let's figure out how we can fix that. And I don't know, there's I had a friend who was like, oh my God, Alice, you're gonna try to push ethical capitalism. And I was just like, okay, we're not gonna get political with this, but I think, you know, business is business. There's a way to do it kindly, ethically, and like enjoyable for all.
Yeah.
And it's empathy for one another. It's the biggest thing. So
definitely.
That's kind of my advice.
And then I always like wrapping up my podcast with this question, and you can kind of take it in any different direction because you've had multiple facets to your career. What advice do you have for young professionals just starting their career?
Stick with it. Stick with it for 2 years. Don't, you know, I see too many young people go, and I say that having been reviewing resumes for a coordinator with 4 to 5 years of experience. I see resumes where they've been 9 months to a year at a firm and then leave and go try something new. Stick with a hard thing for at least 2 years and learn from it. Don't leave because you're uncomfortable. Don't leave because it's hard. Adulting is hard. You'll figure mm-hmm. it out. You'll get there. But stick with it. I was really proud of my resume because I was a superintendent for 3 years and then 5 years with another company. And I can tell you right now, I can confidently say if Wonderstruck didn't work out, I have 3, 5, and 5 year tenure in places. I'm going to get a good job. And there is something, you build a lot of grit and a lot, you learn a lot. If you have to do a hard thing for a long time, you need that mental endurance in the workplace to be successful, or else, you know, you're going to end up really unhappy in your late 20s, going from job to job and still not quite knowing what you want to be and not knowing how to work with others. Stick with it.
And there's so many different things that we do that, like, I know you mentioned, you know, you had your schedule for a house and it was 55 days. Most buildings aren't. And if you're in residential, unless you're doing the bigger mass just cookie cutter homes, that's how you're moving at that speed. Even the custom homes take longer than that, or commercial construction. I may be in construction for 2 years and it's design was probably a year and a half before that. So it's okay. If you're only there for 9 months, you only got a small glimpse of either part of the design process or just a peek into construction. You didn't get to see a project from proposal all the way through construction and closeout. And that's so important. If I see somebody that's hopped a bunch, then it's like, what have you seen? What haven't you seen?
That's so true.
You may have 15 years of experience, but if you've worked at 15 different firms, were you laid off or what do you know? Granted, I say if somebody is uncomfortable in a position, don't feel like you have to stay there 2 years. But if it's just hard, deal with the hard and you'll learn things along the way and that'll help you define where to go. But no, I think that's super important, especially in the AEC industry. It's different when you watch other, you know, just business professionals or accountants. It's like, okay, you hit a billing cycle every month and you hit the end of the year. Like, it's the same thing every month. So.
Well, and care enough about your work and job reputation that just because you have a couple hard days doesn't mean you're like, ugh, I'm out. I don't want to do this. Like, people who do that get a reputation. I'm just going to say it. They're job hoppers is a term for a reason. And usually it's not until you're in your late 20s and you're not getting a job and you're frustrated and you don't know why. And it's because you haven't stuck anything out. You haven't learned anything. You haven't seen a building go into fruition.
And from a business owner standpoint, that's a risk. Because it's, hey, I'm going to train you up, let you know what we do, put you in front of clients. And if you only stick something out 8-9 months, if I was hiring somebody for Mentor Dino, I wouldn't be able to do it. Because especially when you're going for a small firm, a startup, you need to find other people that are passionate. So it's like finding Donna for you. And it's like, nope, you guys are in it, come in as a partnership, and it's going to be hard.
Yeah, it nailed it. It's so expensive to hire people. So expensive. Yeah. And then I put my own money at risk. I put a lot of my own. So if I'm looking at a resume, and now I appreciate it more. When I was corporate and I helped a little with recruiting with one of the companies I worked for, I could take a little more of a risk, right? I didn't necessarily, I was like, oh, they're kind of a job hopper. They may work out, they may not. Well, let's see.
Yeah. It's not my money at risk.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not taking that risk with Wonderstruct. I've put a lot of my own personal money into this company. No way. If you've hopped around a ton, nope, that's not going to work. And you could have hopped around to the top AEC companies in the country and still not going to happen. So I like that. Yeah. But I like that point you made, like, see a job through fruition. Most of the projects, design and construction, have like a 2-year time frame, why wouldn't just stick it out? If you're in a hard phase, just know it's going to be over soon. You're going to probably get into another hard phase, but stick it out because it's so rewarding.
Yeah, because then you learn from your own mistakes, which can be hard in construction, but that's where the biggest lessons learned, and they're the most memorable, I find, because you're learning visually, you're in the field, you're seeing it, and it's just a whole different level than drawing it and thinking it'll work. But then it's like, I definitely teach young architects, like, hey, great, you did this detail. How big is a drill? Can the drill actually get in to put this in? And just trying to get people to think like a contractor or a sub that would have to put together. It's like, if you haven't done enough, go do some mini house project. And then you'll learn on just the components and what you need. So
go do roofing for a summer. Like, and just build empathy and appreciation for the people who are putting up what you design, and vice versa. And vice versa. You know, I remember when I was in school, I was in the construction program. I also worked in an office with architectural drawings, and like the amount of detail and red line and review and review and review that we went through just made me appreciate, like, architecture isn't just like scribbling a pretty drawing and here, hope you build it. Like, I, you know, it's the attention to detail is super important. So just understanding all of the different components of what you're building and who puts effort into that, and then, and trying to empathize with how they do their job. It's always so important.
Definitely. And so if anyone was super interested in getting a hold of you with any questions, whether it be career driven or looking for your help with Wonderstruck and helping out their business, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Great question. So first, check out our website. It's wonderstruck.co.co. Still working on getting the com domain. Or you can email me, Alice, and it's A-L-Y-C-E. My mother got a little wild and threw a Y in there. Alice@wonderstruck.co. And you can shoot me an email. And I am an open book, always happy to talk about the business, always happy to mentor. I have plenty of mentors myself. And yeah, love chatting about this sort of stuff.
Yep. And I'll leave links to your website and your email all below, so it's a quick access for anybody. And I'll try to look up some of the other organizations we talked about just to put those down below as well.
Awesome.
But thank you so much, Alice, for taking the time to speak with me today. This was a fantastic conversation. I think we could have gone on for another hour.
Oh, for sure. I've absolutely loved it. So anytime, I love these sort of conversations and not get more people in our industry.
I hope you enjoyed our discussion today. Check out the description below for any resources, links, and contact information we discussed. Did you like the conversation today? Is there something you'd like to know more about or a topic I should cover? Leave me a comment below and I will see what I can do to best answer your questions. And if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the channel. It does really help others be able to find this resource to have larger conversations. So leave me a comment and subscribe. I really appreciate your support.